Have you ever thought about having a favorite place, or do you have a favorite place on earth? Kathy and I, as I said, are planning to leave for London to visit London. If Hurricane Harvey doesn't spoil the plans, I don't think it's going to, not the way the forecasts are. We're going to take some much-needed vacation time, as well as heading over to the wedding of Kathy's oldest nephew, Joshua Gillis. It seems the summer has been a very busy one for me, and I'm looking forward to a little break to get a little bit of time before and then be there for the wedding and a couple of days afterwards to visit in London. I've been blessed as I think back over my life. I've not been a huge world traveler, but I've been around the United States quite a bit, and I've seen some very interesting things. I love the view of the Grand Canyon every time I've gone. A couple of times went down to the lower plateau and back up the same day. I won't do that again. I'm past the age of doing that. But it's a beautiful sight, a beautiful thing to see. I love the Rocky Mountains. Enjoy Colorado. I've seen the Statue of Liberty. Been able to see the Empire, go to the top of the Empire State Building, at least as far as we could go. I've been able to travel a few places. A couple of places like Canada, Mexico, a little bit internationally, England, mainly Bricket Wood in London, and then the Dig in Jerusalem, got to see a little bit of Europe at the end of that particular trip. So a little bit of world travel for me, but I'm excited for Kathy to be able to visit London for the first time that she will be able to remember anything. She was there as an infant before, but hasn't been there since then. But if you were asked to name a favorite place, or if I were asked to name a favorite place, I guess I would probably have to name a couple that I've thought were just absolutely beautiful, beautiful places to see. Some people have one favorite place that they love above all others. Now, if you're one of those people, you're in good company, because if you didn't realize it, the Bible tells us God has a favorite place on this planet too. I want to talk to you about that today. I want to explore a little bit about that in this sermon today. The title of the sermon is simply called Zion, the City of God. I want to talk about Zion. What is Zion? What makes it so special to God that we could say it is his favorite place on this planet, or his favorite city? Why does it matter to us, or should it matter to us? I'd like to see if we can explore a little bit in the Bible today and see if we can answer those questions. Now, first of all, let's talk about what is it. What is Zion? If you study some of the different sources, commentaries, or different books that will give you information about Zion, biblical Zion, you'll find that there's some difference of opinion as to the exact location. You know, there's no doubt that it refers to a Jebusite stronghold that was conquered by one of David's men or by his army, and that became the city of David. Now, I'll mention I have a couple of slides that I'll share with you in just a minute, so they might be getting that ready. But I want to turn to 2 Samuel chapter 5, first of all. 2 Samuel chapter 5, if you'll turn there with me. We'll notice what we read about Zion here. 2 Samuel chapter 5. And this talks about the time that the tribes of Israel came to David after Saul's death, and David was established as king. And verse 3 talks about all the elders of Israel came to David at Hebron, and David made a covenant with them. And let's pick it up in verse 4 now. 2 Samuel chapter 5 and verse 4. So David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who spoke to David, saying, "You know, you won't come up here, you shall not come in here, but the blind and the lame will repel you." Now, there's a reason they said that, and that was because it was a stronghold. Their city was on the top of a little hill with some ravines on most, at least three sides of it, as some sources say. And they were thinking, even the lame and the blind could repel your men. I mean, there's no way y'all are going to scale this place. No way you're going to take it. David cannot come in here. Verse 7 says, "Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion." That is, notice the parenthetical thought, that is the city of David. So Zion is equated with the city of David, because that's where David then built his city once he conquered Zion, once he conquered this Jebusite stronghold. Verse 8, now David said on that day, whoever climbs up by way of the water shaft and defeats the Jebusites, the lame and the blind who are hated by David's soul, he shall be chief and captain. Now, I think there's some Hebrew humor in that parenthetical thought. I don't know that I quite get it. I might have to stand up because it's probably gone over my head a little bit, but I think that parenthetical thought is supposed to be humorous. You know, these lame and, you know, that are supposed to repel us, well, I'll let the lame, you know, come up and conquer you. Maybe that, I don't know what the humor in it is, but it seems to have been that way. Anyway, it says, he shall be chief and captain, whoever defeats them. Therefore, they say, the blind and the lame shall not come into the house. Then David dwelt in the stronghold, and he called it the city of David. And David built all around from the Millo and inward. Now, this is the first biblical mention of Zion. If you look up, again, different sources, many times people are interested in the etymology of the word. That is, where did the word come from? What does it mean? And what language did it come from? Is it a combination of different languages? And if you read some of that, I'll spare you a lot of the details of it, but you'll find that it's somewhat disputed. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, ISBE for short, says that the two most attractive and probably the most probable are from a Semitic root in Arabic that means protect, or from an Aramaic word that means tower on top of a mountain. So they say if you kind of put those two ideas together, maybe a good combination of them would be a protected or a fortified tower. That's the name meant. It was a protected place. It was a fortified place. And this passage makes it very clear that the Jebusite stronghold was on a hill of some kind that made it easily defensible, that they could repel anybody who tried to take this particular city. I won't turn to 1 Chronicles 11, verse 6. You can jot it down if you want to check this, if you're a fact checker that likes to look these things up. But that passage in 1 Chronicles 11, 6 tells us that Joab is the one that made it up that water shaft and that was able to conquer the city. And therefore, David made him the head of his troops. He put him in charge of his army. Now, it tells us that David built the city, and he called it the city of David there, dwelt in that stronghold. And notice it says he built all around from the Millo and inward. Now, my margin says the Millo means the landfill. So David, to put it in the modern vernacular, built on a garbage dump. He just coated over it, layered it, and built it up, and sort of leveled that area off where it used to be a steep incline that would keep people from coming up into that stronghold. David raised that plane up and made it a little bit more level, made it a little bit easier to get around in that city, to enlarge the city. And eventually that area took in what became Jerusalem and took in all of that area, the city of David, along with a lot rest of the surrounding hills and valleys. Now, there are six or seven hills around Jerusalem. The exact location of the one that was this Jebusite stronghold, or the city of Zion, is disputed. Like many locations in the Bible, ancient Bible locations, you can find different people who hold different theories on where those particular locations are. Some of them are pretty well set, but others are disputed. Now, ISBE has a very long article under the section Modern Research, and it points out that the 19th century scholar, E. Robinson, asserted that the location had to be on the southwestern side of Jerusalem. If this is Jerusalem and you're looking to the southwest side, that's where there's a larger hill. It's the largest hill in the area. And they said, well, that has to be the one. Robinson said, it's got to be the one. Indisputable. And yet, they go on to say that studies in the last century, in the 20th century, in the 1900s, studies have shown that no, it probably wasn't on the southwestern side, it was probably on the southeastern side. That's probably where Zion was, that it was not the western but the eastern side. It was one of those ridges on that part. Now, I have a couple of slides to show you here. Let me show you, first of all, one that takes the view of E. Robinson and the scholars up until the last century. This one is actually from Wikipedia, and I don't know if you can read all of the attribution on the bottom, but actually Wikimedia is the source of this. But to help you get the bearings on this, this is looking at the city of Jerusalem, the big outer outline, or the city walls, a more modern city, but this is kind of the traditional view. On the east side of the area is an area marked off as Mount Moriah. Now, that's the area where the temple was built. I'm showing you a little circle around that. That's the area on which the temple was built. This large temple mount area is actually probably that whole area that is, or was that whole area that is that square. But the temple was sort of in that center area of it. Now, I've also added a circle and a text with an arrow to point out the approximate location of the Mount of Olives. This is a topographical map, so when the lines get close together, that means there's steeper elevation. When it gets wider, that's more of a valley, so those steep elevations on that eastern side to the east of Mount Moriah, to the east of where the temple was, that's the area, the general area of the Mount of Olives. I've also drawn a red circle around what E. Robinson and other scholars used to think was the city of David. Now, or the Mount Zion that was built as the city of David. Now, interestingly, they also included an area marked City of David just south of the temple area. Let's see, I think I can check my notes here and see if I actually put a circle around that. I didn't, but if you look right below the area of the Temple Mount, the last words you see down the bottom there are City of David, which is now recognized as the true Mount Zion. That scholars believe that is more of the appropriate area for it. Now, here's a second slide. This particular slide is from BibleStudy.org, showing again the Old Testament this time, the Old Testament outline of Jerusalem. They make a big issue, if you can read up at the top, they make a big issue of seven hills being around the city of Jerusalem, not all of them in the city, so it wasn't actually built on seven hills, but seven hills being around it. But the main reason for showing this is that they put Mount Zion on the ridge and a peak by the Kidron Valley. And they labeled that as Mount Zion. You'll see that in the pink area toward the bottom, right below that green area, which is sort of that raised area of Mount Moriah and the Temple Mount. Now, they have the Mount of Olives, again, off to the east, just to the east of where the temple would have been. And they have the city of David and Mount Zion down south of the Temple Mount. Well, this is probably what more modern scholars believe was the accurate site of Zion or the city of David. Now, you'll note they also have a place called New Mount Zion on there because modern or the scholars of the 19th century, 1800s, felt that was where Mount Zion was. So several places. Let's go to a couple of places in the Bible where, and I'll leave this slide up for just a little while here for some reference. Let's go to a couple of places where Zion is mentioned. Mount Zion, Psalm 78, first of all. Let's go to the book of Psalms. In Psalm 78, and verse 68. Notice Psalm 78 in verse 68. Speaking about God, it says, but he chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loved. And he built his sanctuary like the heights, like the earth, which he has established forever. So it's Mount Zion, which he loved. God loved Mount Zion. It's a place that was very special and is very special to God. And Psalm 78 tells us that. If we go to Psalm 132, we find another passage where there is a statement about God's love for this particular location on planet Earth. Psalm 132. Now let's begin in verse 13. Psalm 132, verses 13 and 14. He says, for the Lord has chosen Zion. He has desired it for his dwelling place. Now my margin says that means the word home, or it means home. He chose this as his home. He has desired it for his dwelling place. Verse 14, this is my resting place forever. Here I will dwell, for I have desired it. So this is one of the songs of ascent, if you look at the title of this particular song. So again, shows God's great affinity for this particular location. Now, these songs of ascents later, when the temple was built, began to be or were part of apparently a group of songs that were sung on the way up to the Temple Mount. And the Temple Mount was there around that area of Mount Zion. But notice that he's chosen that as his dwelling place. Where did he dwell? Well, he said the dwelling was going to be in at that temple. So Zion, we'll find, I'll go over this a little bit more as we go along here, but this particular area, this use of the word Zion, is expanded. It began with the city of David. Zion was changed to the city of David. He built his city there. So I want to spend a little bit of time taking you through the progression of the use of Zion in the Bible, because it did expand from simply that one mountain south of the Temple Mount in a part of the area of Jerusalem. It expanded to include more than that. It included the temple, it included even the entire city of Jerusalem, and as we'll see, it's expanded even beyond that in some places. When David built the temple after David's death, Zion was used to refer that whole area. So let's take a look at this. Let's notice that it has its beginning in David's lifetime. Let's go back to 1 Chronicles, this time chapter 21. 1 Chronicles chapter 21. I guess we were in 2 Chronicles a while ago, but 1 Chronicles, during the life of David. 1 Chronicles 21. Now, to give you the background of this particular chapter, if you go to verse 1, this is the passage, or this is the section, I referred to this last week or 2 weeks ago, Satan moving David to number the children of Israel. How many men of war do I have? Horrible mistake David made. He ended up paying for that, and we're going to skip down to the end of the story, because God, what David chose was not to fall into the hands of his enemies, but to let God bring a plague, let God take care of the issue. And God did destroy. A lot of men died because of David's mistake. You might say, well, that was unfair. In one sense, it was unfair. But it was a consequence because David numbered the men of war, and God allowed those people to die because of that. And we pick it up in verse 16. David lifted up his eyes, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing between the earth and heaven, having in his hand a drawn sword stretched out over Jerusalem. So David's looking at this, and he sees this drawn sword, and it's over the whole city of Jerusalem, and David panics. Oh no, he's going to destroy all of Jerusalem. He's already killed all these thousands of individuals. And David saw that. So David and the elders, clothed in sackcloth, fell on their faces. And David said to God, "Was it not I who commanded the people to be numbered? I'm the one who has sinned and done this evil indeed. But these sheep, what have they done? Let your hand, I pray, O Lord, my God, be against me and my father's house, but not against your people, that they should be plagued." Therefore, God listened, didn't he? God listened to David's prayer. Therefore, it says, the angel of the Lord commanded Gad to say to David that David should go and erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Ornan, the Jebusite. So David went up. Wait a minute. Jebusite. Where did we hear the Jebusites before? Zion. Was one of their strongholds, wasn't it? Anyway, Ornan, David went up at the word of Gad, verse 19, which he had spoken in the name of the Lord, and Ornan turned and saw the angel, and his four sons who were with him hid themselves, but Ornan continued threshing wheat. So David came to Ornan, and Ornan looked and saw David, and he went out from the threshing floor and bowed before David with his face to the ground. And David said, "Grant me this place of this threshing floor, that I may build an altar on it to the Lord. Shall grant it to me at full price, that the plague may be withdrawn from the people." Ornan began to argue with him and said, "No, I'll give it to you." And David said, "No, I'm not taking it as a gift. I own this problem. This was my mistake. I'm paying you full price for it." And so David did pay full price. Notice David didn't arbitrarily pick this spot. God chose this spot. And he told David, "Go by that spot at that threshing floor and build an altar there." Now, if you know anything about ancient history and ancient harvest practices, the way they would separate the wheat from the chaff is with a threshing floor. They would put the wheat out into a space, and they would scoop it up in the air, and they would let the breeze blow the chaff away, and the grain would fall back to the threshing floor. Well, where do you get breeze? Well, I can tell you it's not at the bottom of a valley. you won't get much breeze most of the time at the bottom of a valley unless it happens to blow right along that channel. Most of the time it would be an elevated location, maybe toward the top of a hill of some kind. So this is where Ornan's threshing floor was. And notice the altar and the tabernacle were not here at that particular time. They were elsewhere. Let's continue with the story. And let's see, did I read verse 22? I did. Let's go to verse 29. It says, at verse 29, verse 28, at that time when David saw the Lord had answered him on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, he sacrificed there. For the tabernacle of the Lord and the altar of the burnt offering, which Moses had made in the wilderness, were at that time at the high place of Gibeon. So they were still at Gibeon when this happened, when God told David to build this particular altar. And so chapter 22, verse 1, that David said, "This is the house of the Lord God, and this is the altar of burnt offering for Israel." So this chapter talks about David setting out to build a temple on that location where God had had him build this altar. I'm not going to read through the chapter. I think you know the whole story. God stopped him and said, "Wait a minute. It's a great idea, David. But did I ever say I needed a house to dwell in? When did I ever say I needed a permanent house? I didn't ask you to do this. I know it's in your heart. You dwell in this nice cedar home and I'm in a tent. I don't need it. But I tell you what, I won't let you build that house. You've shed too much blood. You've been a man of war. But your son, who will be a man of peace, I will let him build a temple. I'll let him build a house for me." And where did Solomon build that? Let's go to 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles chapter 3, where we find David has died and Solomon reigns in his place in chapter 1. And skip to chapter 3, where we find Solomon beginning to build the temple that David wanted to build. And actually, he began collecting materials for it through the rest of his life. And before he died, he told Solomon, "Here are all these things I've collected. Use them to build the temple." Chapter 3, verse 1, 2 Chronicles 3, 1 says, "Now Solomon began to build the house of the Lord," that's the temple, "at Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to his father David at the place that David had prepared on the threshing floor of Ornan, the Jebusite." Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah. Remember the Mount Moriah of the slide before? It's where the Temple Mount was. That's where David was told to build the altar. And that's where David began to build, or wanted to build, the temple of God. And that's where Solomon actually built the temple. It's the exact same place, that threshing floor that David built or bought. So it was up on a hill. It was on the top of Mount Moriah. Now, as we move into the time of the prophets, we see that it's Zion begins to be used for the tabernacle. Not the tabernacle, the temple. The tabernacle is where God dwelt before. Now there's a temple. So it's beginning to be used in a little bit different way. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 8. There are lots of statements in the prophets about Zion and describing Zion and God's love for it. But notice how it's used in Isaiah 8. Isaiah chapter 8, and it looks like the sentence begins at verse 17, so I guess we'll start there. Isaiah 8, verses 17 and 18. It says, "I will wait on the Lord who hides his face from the house of Jacob, and I will hope in him. Here am I and the children whom the Lord has given me. We are for signs and wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells in Mount Zion." So where was God's temple? Where was it that God dwelt? Well, he dwelt in the temple, and he's calling the temple Mount Zion, Mount Moriah, which was in that area that was the original Mount Zion, the Jebusite stronghold that became the city of David. And David expanded that city, and then he built a tabernacle, began to build a temple, wanted to build a temple, and his son Solomon built that temple on that threshing floor. So we see that Isaiah describes this as where God dwells is in Mount Zion. Now, let's go to Ezekiel chapter 8. Look at Ezekiel's statement. As I said, there are many of these. I had to pare this down to just pick a couple of them. Ezekiel chapter 8. And let's get down to verse 15. Now this is God has appeared, or an angel has appeared to Ezekiel, and he is in a vision, seeing the temple, seeing Jerusalem. Verse 3 mentions that the Spirit lifted me up between the earth and heaven, brought me in visions of God to Jerusalem, to the north gate of the inner court. That would be the temple in Jerusalem. So let's get down to verse 15. Ezekiel 8 and verse 15. And then he said to me, this angel or this spirit being, "Have you seen this, O son of man? Turn again, you will see greater abominations than these." So he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house, the temple, and there at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east. And they were worshiping the sun toward the east. The temple is described as God's house. That's what his house is. So he dwelt in Zion, as Isaiah says, in Jerusalem. I mean, Ezekiel makes it very clear the temple is God's house. Now, as I mentioned, then this was also expanded in the prophets to include all of Jerusalem, Jerusalem as a whole. Let's go to Zechariah chapter 8. Zechariah chapter 8. There are a number of places in the minor prophets where this usage shows up. But in Zechariah, next to the last book in the Old Testament, Zechariah chapter 8 and verse 3, "Thus says the Lord, I will return to Zion and dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Jerusalem shall be called the city of truth, the mountain of the Lord of hosts, the holy mountain." This seems to be a passage that uses the Hebrew sense of parallelism. In other words, make a statement, make another statement that's equal but expounds on it a little bit. The location, the city, Zion, the city of Jerusalem. I'll return to Zion, I'll dwell in the midst of the city of Jerusalem. Well, Zion was a part of Jerusalem, but it seems to be including all of Jerusalem, because he's calling all of Jerusalem the city of truth, the mountain of the Lord of hosts, the holy mountain. So now Zion is expanded to include all of Jerusalem. That it's, yes, that spot where David first had his men conquer the Jebusite stronghold. And yes, it was the city of David. And then it was the mount where that Ornan's threshing floor and the altar was built. And then the temple was built. And then it includes all of that area, which is all within the old city walls of Jerusalem. That Jerusalem is called the city of truth, the mountain of the Lord, the holy mountain. This is, again, one of many places where Mount Zion, Zion, Jerusalem are used interchangeably. And we get into some of the prophecies about Zion in this passage, which is part of why it should matter to us. We'll come back to that and see that a little bit more detail later. But notice Isaiah even uses these somewhat interchangeably. In Isaiah chapter 52, let's go back to Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 52. Let's begin in the first verse. Isaiah 52 verse 1 says, "Awake, awake, put on your strength, O Zion. Put on your beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city. For the uncircumcised and the unclean shall no longer come to you. Shake yourself from the dust, arise, sit down, O Jerusalem, loose yourself from the bonds of your neck, O captive daughter of Zion." Zion and Jerusalem are used interchangeably in this passage, even by Isaiah. The holy city, Jerusalem's called. Zion is used to apply to all of them, to all of God's people, actually, to all of Judah, but specifically to Jerusalem. Jerusalem, in that sense, pictures all of Judah, God's special people. Now, if we take this to the furthest extent in the New Testament, we even find a reference to the church. That's found in the book of Hebrews. We could see Zion in a sense, referring to even the people of God in the New Testament. Turn to me with Hebrews chapter 12. Take a look at this passage. Hebrews chapter 12. The passage talks about early on, about not being upset if we are corrected, if we receive some chastisement, that God does that for our benefit, for our good, so that we will produce fruit. When we skip down a little bit later, that's around chapter, verse 7, 8, 9, 10. Let's skip down a little bit later. And he talks, let's pick it up in, he's talking about what happened when Israel came out of Egypt. They saw the mountain, the great darkness and the tempest, the sound of the trumpet, verse 19 and 20. They couldn't endure it. It was a terrifying sight. So verse 22, he says, but you have come. You haven't come to that physical mountain, like Mount Sinai, but you, in the New Testament, you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven, to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, to the blood and sprinkling that speaks better things than of Abel. So this heavenly Jerusalem, an innumerable company of angels, the general assembly and church of the firstborn, to Zion. They're equated or they're linked in some way here. So we have a pretty good reason that it should matter to us that Zion is something that's very special to God, because it includes his people. It's the people that he's worked with, and it's the people that he's working with now. But what about the singular place, if we think in terms of Zion or Jerusalem today? Is it a peaceful, beautiful spot on this planet? If anyone has seen a picture of Jerusalem in any recent century, I think you would say, no, that's not what it looks like today. It's not a beautiful place. It's not a special place in that sense. In fact, it's one of the most hotly contested places in the whole world between Jews and Arabs. Extremely full of unrest. I was reading an article that kind of piqued my interest in this again just this week. Actually, this is from an article. This is a synopsis of an article from Aruz Shiva, which are it's the Israeli national news is what it is. This particular article, let's see if I can find, there it is. This was, it's dated August 22nd. So, it was a few days back, 3 or 4 days ago. Says the Supreme Islamic Council in Jerusalem is denying any religious or historic connection of the Jewish people to the Temple Mount, now calling the entire compound the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So not just the mosque that sits on top of the Temple Mount, they are calling that entire temple compound Al-Aqsa. They're calling it theirs and saying Jews have no historic or religious connection to it. A statement issued by the council on Monday declared that the area of the Al-Aqsa Mosque covers 144 dunams, whatever dunams are, belongs exclusively to Muslims, according to the decision of Allah, since Muhammad's ascension to heaven and until Judgment Day. Quote, the Muslims will not give up one grain of the land of the Al-Aqsa Mosque because it is part of the faith of 2 billion Muslims worldwide. And without Muslims, there is no connection to Al-Aqsa in the past or in the future. And there is no recognition of any right the Jewish people have to it. The statement says, talk about hotly contested. You have no right to this Temple Mount whatsoever. There was no temple. The Jews have no claim to the temple. Ancient Israel has no claim to that property whatsoever. And unfortunately, this is what many Muslims are going to teach their children. They're going to indoctrinate them with that from the very beginning, to tell them Jews have no connection, they have no history with this particular area. Now, if we go to Zechariah chapter 12, it shouldn't be a surprise to us that we find such a powerful and really a hateful statement toward the Jews being declared today. Zechariah chapter 12, We find in verse 1, it says, "The burden of the Lord, word of the Lord against Israel, thus says the Lord, who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundations of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness." Or the margin says, a reeling. It's like they decided to translate it as drunkenness, but it can be a reeling, like you're getting punched from one side and then the other. You're just kind of rocked on your heels. Totally unsteady. "To all the surrounding peoples, when they lay siege against Judah and Jerusalem, and it shall happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces, though all nations of the earth are gathered against it." Jerusalem, Zion, God's city, what will be called the holy city, is destined to be the seat of great controversy. Nations might want to help, but all that would want to help and then want to get out of it and say, no, we don't, you know, realize we can't do anything with it, you're going to pay a price if you try to get away from it. You'll be cut in pieces if you try to heave it away. You get embroiled in something from which you cannot extricate yourself. It's been the case in modern times. Really, ever since the Jewish state was established under the United Nations Resolution 181 in May 1984. You know, the British mandate expired in May of 1948. Did I say 84? I meant 48. Dyslexic. Not 84, 48. 1948, the Jewish mandate expired. And on the 14th of May, the Jewish state was established. The plan, actually at that time, under the United Nations resolution, was that there was to be a Jewish area, there was to be an Arab area, and then there was to be this area around the temple that was still maintained or controlled internationally. And the Jewish state was established, and immediately the Arabs attacked the new nation of Israel. And within 10 months, Israel no longer controlled just the area that was destined for the Jews. The new nation of Israel now also controlled about 60% of the area that was supposed to be for Arabs. So this new nation of Israel took over much of the territory that was supposed to be an Arab state. So why do the Arabs call them imposters who are living on their land? Well, because part of the land they're on is land that originally was supposed to be for the Arabs. But God didn't intend it to be that way, apparently. He helped the new nation of Israel get established. I believe it was his hand in that. So we've seen that it is special to God. We've seen that Zion began with the city of David, that it expanded in its use of the prophets of old to include all of Jerusalem, and we could perhaps say even all of Judah, and in the New Testament, perhaps the people of God today. Let's ask the question, why is it so special to God? Why? Why is it that God looks so favorably on that city? Many people have asked that question. I have a quote for you from Teddy Kollek. He was Jerusalem's mayor from 1965 to 1993. This quote comes from the Believer's Bible Commentary on Psalm 87. We'll turn there and look at Psalm 87 in a minute. But I found it interesting to note Teddy Kollek asking that same question. Why is Jerusalem so special? Why is it unique? Here's the quote. "Archaeologists and historians have long wondered why Jerusalem should have been established where it was and why it should have become great. It enjoys none of the physical features which favored the advancement and prosperity of other important cities in the world. It stands at the head of no great river. It overlooks no great harbor. It commands no great highway and no crossroads. It's not close to abundant sources of water, often the major reason for establishment of a settlement, though one main natural spring offers a modest supply. It has no mineral resources. It was off the main trade routes. It held no strategic key to the conquest of vast areas prized by the ancient warring empires. Indeed, it was blessed with neither special economic nor topographic virtues, which might explain why it should ever have become more than a small, anonymous mountain village with a fate any different from those of most contemporary villages that have long since vanished." So the mayor of a city says, I don't know why we'd be as good as we are. There's no reason for it, other than God decided it was going to be a special place. Let's look at Psalm 78, as I said. Let's look for a little insight there. Go to Psalm 87 with me, Psalm 87. Sorry for the dyslexia today. Needed another cup of coffee, didn't I? Psalm 87. I was going to tell you I was going to read the whole chapter, but it's only seven verses, so no big deal, right? I will take a little bit of time to look at several of these, though, in segments. Let's start with the first three verses. Psalm 87, verse 1, His foundation is in the holy mountains. The Lord loves the gates of Zion more than all the dwellings of Jacob. Glorious things are spoken of you, O city of God. Kind of has a ring of a hymn, doesn't it? Glorious things of thee are spoken, or well, however the phrase goes. But notice the foundations. His foundation is in the holy mountains. The Lord loves Zion more than all the other dwellings. There's a lot of imagery in these first three verses. A lot of things that we can think about. You know, the foundation can be what things are built on. It's the groundwork. They're the basic tenets, the basic beliefs, the basic teachings, the basic tenets of God's way, the basic understanding of God's truth, the basic understanding of God's government, what His government is based on, what His kingdom is based on. And they're found in this city. It's on a mountain. A mountain is typically a place of safety, isn't it? It's a place of refuge. You escape the rising tides of waters. When we think of God's way being higher than man's way, it's not where most of mankind is. This is a higher. It's a place of refuge for those who try to live God's way. And we're not embroiled in the ways of the world. God's people can find refuge from the carnality, the spiritual darkness, the evil that so besets our world, that's ruled, filled with sorrow and suffering due to being dominated by Satan. Now, there's a lot of imagery when we look at it from this perspective. God's holy mountain that's elevated above man's way of doing things. There's safety. There's peace. There's a calm there. Remember we read in Hebrews 12 about the church coming to Mount Zion, the heavenly Jerusalem. Let's notice a statement about this. You can place something if you want here in Psalm 48. I'm going 87, so I can go back and forth. But in Psalm 48, we'll go there and then come back to 87, Psalm 48. Psalm 48, beginning at verse 1, it says, Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in His holy mountain. Here again, this reference to God's city, to God's holy mountain, Zion. Beautiful, verse 2, in elevation. The joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. God is in her palaces. He is known as her refuge. The joy of the whole earth. Beautiful. The joy of the whole earth. Joy and refuge are available to those who have a relationship with God, who are living His way of life. God offers us that joy. He offers us refuge. He offers us peace. Physical Jerusalem, Zion, is anything but the joy of the whole earth right now, isn't it? I mean, it's a place of great contention, great hostility. But Zion is symbolic of the time when that's going to change. You know, we're blessed to already have a foretaste of the world tomorrow. We're blessed to have that relationship with God and the peace that comes from that relationship. The whole world eventually is going to have an opportunity for that, but they don't have it right now. That's part of the future. See, as we start thinking about Zion, I keep thinking about the fall festivals and all of the things that the fall festivals picture and all of the prophecies of what's going to come and what Zion is going to become, what Jerusalem is going to become. A joy, a blessing to the whole world. Notice Paul used this imagery. Let's go to the New Testament. Go to Philippians chapter 3. Philippians chapter 3. and about peace and joy and refuge. We go to Philippians chapter 3. Philippians 3 and verse 1, he says, "Finally, my brethren, rejoice in the Lord." Rejoice, have joy. Be happy that you know God. Be happy that you know His way of life. Rejoice in this. For me to write the same things to you is not tedious, but for you it's safe. It's safe for you to hear these things, and it's safe for you to think in terms of joy because of your relationship with God, because you're dedicated to Him. Paul knew Psalm 87 was describing that place of refuge. It was describing Zion. It was describing God's dwelling. And that we have a chance to come to God's dwelling now. We have a chance to come to that fortress on a hill, a place of security, knowing our place in God's plan, knowing the prophecies that God has revealed to us, that He's revealed in His Word, about what's coming to this planet. Yes, a time of difficulty between now and the return of Jesus Christ, but a time of great peace after Satan is taken out of the way. The whole fall festival season is heavily prophetic. It describes Christ's coming, describes the putting away of the one who is the source of evil, Satan, moving him away from mankind, putting an end to Satan's diabolical rule, removing his influence, and then God setting up His government with Jesus Christ returning, Him setting up His rule in Mount Zion in Jerusalem. God's law, God's way of life, God's foundational truths being taught to the entire world. Giving everyone an opportunity for peace, for safety, and for joy. No wonder God loves Zion. No wonder it's so special to Him, because He sees the end result. He sees where it's heading. He sees what it's going toward. And He loves what it signifies. Let's go back now to Psalm 87. So that foundation, that understanding of the principles of God's way of life are the things that will bring peace. Not conflict and war and hatred and fighting, but peace and happiness. No wonder God loves what it signifies. Let's pick it up in verse 4, or let's read verse 4. It says, "I will make mention of Rahab and Babylon to those who know me. Behold, O Philistia and Tyre with Ethiopia, this one was born there." Now let's pause for a moment. Why mention Rahab and Babylon? Well, who were the two great enemies of ancient Israel? The two great enemies of ancient Israel, I would say, were Egypt and Babylon. Babylon, the one who conquered them. Egypt, who enslaved them. God led them out of that slavery. But then Babylon, who took them captive. So why mention Rahab instead of saying Egypt? It's a good question, isn't it? Let's hold your place here, and let's go to Isaiah 30. Notice what Isaiah 30 says. This could be a reference to why God is using Rahab there. Isaiah chapter 30, and again, I'm not going to read all the context of this, but it's about Israel turning to Egypt for protection. So let's just read verse 7. Isaiah 30, verse 7, it says, "For the Egyptians shall help in vain, and to no purpose. Therefore I," this is God speaking, "therefore I have called her Rahab him Shebeth." Now, I don't pronounce Hebrew too well, so I'm sure I slaughtered that. But what does it mean? That's the question. What does it mean? Well, I looked this up, and I also read a variety of different translations. I have access to about 30 different translations, and different translations translate this different ways. Let me give you a smattering of the translations. Some translate this as Rahab the do-nothing. The do-nothing. You claim that you're going to be the one to give help to Israel. Israel thinks they're going to get help from you, but it's not. You're Israel the do-nothing. You're Rahab the do-nothing. Here's another one. Arrogance doing nothing. Another one. The harmless dragon. Or this one I like. The toothless dragon. The reluctant dragon. And here's another one. The proud one who is silenced. the proud one who is silenced. Speaking great things, but you're silenced because you can't follow through on any of them. You have no power to follow through on them. The point that Isaiah was making was that it was useless to look to Egypt for help. Egypt couldn't save them. And even Babylon, who conquered and captured them, will, as we saw in Psalm 87, eventually both Egypt and Babylon, it's going to be said of them, well, this one was born here. This isn't a Babylonian anymore. This is someone who's born in Jerusalem. But this is no longer an Egyptian. This is someone who was born in Jerusalem, born in Zion. How could it be that they were born in Zion? Well, it's describing a rebirth, isn't it? Isn't that what conversion is? It's a rebirth. It's a total change of character, total change of mind. I would say it seems to be what God is saying about them, that even Egypt and Babylon are going to change, they're going to be converted, and people are going to say, well, these are just like Israelites. They're born in Zion. They know the foundation of God's way of life, and they're living the foundation of God's way of life. Remember their prophecies about Assyria and Egypt and Israel being three together in the millennium, about them all being in harmony. What an inspiring thing to think about. What an inspiring prophecy to consider. And going on, let's go back to Psalm 87, going on with it. Notice in verse 5, and of Zion it will be said, this one and that one were born in her. And the Most High himself shall establish her. The Lord will record when he registers the peoples, this one was born there. Selah, or so be it, or whatever the Hebrew term Selah means. Some dispute different things, but the point is, it won't be a disgrace to be born in Zion. It won't be a disgrace to be a Christian. It won't be a disgrace to be someone who is converted and living God's way of life. God will take great delight in saying, yes, this is one of my children. This is one who was born in Mount Zion, in my city. It'll be an honor. And last of all, verse 7, both the singers and the players on instruments say, all my springs are in you. Not strings. P. Springs. All my springs are in you. I would have read it with a T if I glanced over it thinking instruments with strings, but it's all my springs. So what's the reference to springs? Well, remember Teddy Kollek? There's only one little spring there. Oh, yeah, it's still up there. I meant to turn this off. But the Gihon Spring is there just to the east or just to the right of the pink area, if you can read that. It may be too small. Gihon Spring. It's the only spring, and there, that was the water that came up that water shaft into the Jebusite stronghold. That was apparently the water shaft that Joab was able to climb up. That's the only water source, only spring in the Jerusalem area. So what does this mean, all my springs are in you? Well, it's quite interesting to think about the fact that water is symbolic of life, and it's symbolic of spiritual life. Jesus said, out of his belly, those who are converted, out of their belly shall flow living water. Water is symbolic of life. So when it says, my springs are in you, they come from Jerusalem. They come from Zion. It's the source of life-giving water. I gave a sermon not too long about some of the incredible properties of water. Turn with me to Joel. Let's look at a few scriptures to talk about water in the millennium. Real briefly, just three. Joel chapter 3, first of all. Again, don't have time to do this in any depth. But in Joel chapter 3, water will flow from Mount Zion, from God's city, from Jerusalem. Joel chapter 3, verses 17 and 18. Joel's only three chapters long. Toward the end of the last chapter, he says in verse 17, so you shall know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Then Jerusalem shall be holy, and no alien shall ever pass through her again. And it shall come to pass in that day that the mountains shall drip with new wine, the hills shall flow with milk, and all the brooks of Judah shall be flooded with water. A fountain shall flow from the house of the Lord, and water in the valley of Achishah. A fountain shall flow from the house of the Lord, from the temple, from God's place of dwelling. A fountain is going to flow from there. Go with me to Zechariah chapter 14. Zechariah chapter 14 also speaks of water flowing from Jerusalem. Zechariah 14 talks about Jesus Christ's feet standing in verse 4 on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. It's going to cleave in two. There's going to be a large valley. Let's skip down to verse 6. It says, It shall come to pass in that day there'll be no light. There will be no light. The lights will diminish. It will be one day which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but at evening time it shall happen that it will be light. And in that day, verse 8, it shall be that living waters shall flow from Jerusalem, half of them toward the eastern sea and half of them toward the western sea. In both summer and winter it shall occur, and the Lord shall be king over all the earth, and that day it shall be the Lord is one and his name one. Living water is going to flow from Jerusalem, east and west. It's going to go both directions to heal the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean, both summer and winter, an endless supply of water. Won't depend on heavy rainfall or snow during the winter for there to be water and that it dries up in the summer. This is a constant flow. And last of all, let's go to Ezekiel chapter 47 and notice another statement about the temple in the future that God speaks about to Ezekiel. This obviously is not happening today, but it's prophetic. It's something that will happen in the future. Ezekiel 47, verse 1, he brought me back to the door of the temple, and there was water flowing from under the threshold of the temple toward the east. For the front of the temple faced east, the water was flowing from under the right side of the temple south of the altar. And he brought me out by way of the north gate and led me around on the outside to the outer gateway that faces east, and there was water running out on the right side. And when the man went out to the east with a line in his hand, he measured 1,000 cubits, and he brought me through the water, and the water came up to my ankles. So 1,000 cubits out, and the water's up to his ankles. He measured 1,000 and brought me through the waters, and the water came to my knees. Measured 1,000 more, and it came to my waist. He measured 1,000 more, and it was a river I couldn't cross because it was too deep. And he said to me, Son of man, verse 6, have you seen this? And he brought me and returned me to the bank of the river. And when I returned, there along the bank of the river were very many trees on one side and the other. And he said to me, this water flows from the eastern region, goes down into the valley and enters the sea. When it reaches the sea, its waters are healed. And it shall be that every living thing that moves, wherever the rivers go, will live. There will be a very great multitude of fish because these waters go there, for they will be healed and everything will live where the water goes. Deeper and deeper, the further away from the temple it got. It defies the laws of physical nature. And yet Ezekiel has shown this miraculous, incredible point of water, life-giving water flowing from Zion, from the temple of God, from God's dwelling. So, what about the last question I posed? Does it matter or should it matter to us that God loves Zion? Well, I think the prophecies make it very plain. It should matter to us. Absolutely. It should matter to us. We should love the fact that God loves it. It's central to prophecy. It's central to God's plan. Let's end with a statement in Isaiah chapter 2. Isaiah chapter 2. I hope this brief overview of God's love for Zion. It's been of some interest to think about what God has in store, why God loves Jerusalem, why he loves Zion. Isaiah chapter 2, beginning in verse 2, it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. To Zion. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between nations and rebuke many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. O house of Jacob, come and let us walk in the light of the Lord. People, all peoples of the earth eventually are going to love Zion. They're going to come to love God's way of life, to love the principles of God's way of life. And they're going to come to love the city where God dwells and rules on this planet.